Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and I'm very happy today that we have Jeremy Black on the network. He's been on many times. He's the author of many, many books about many, many topics. I know that many of the listeners love to hear from Jeremy because he seems to know almost everything. There are some people like that. There really are. Today, what we're going to be talking about is empire, the word empire, and the historical fact of empires, what an empire is, what an empire isn't, what role they have played in history, and similar sorts of things. It'll be a very broad discussion. We might mention some books. We might not mention some books. But I really want to hear what Jeremy has to say about this, because he's written a lot about these sorts of things. And he's from a country that actually had a really big empire at one time, that being, I want to say England, but I know you're not supposed to say that, the United Kingdom. I guess it's still an empire because it's united. Is the United Kingdom an empire, Jeremy?
I'm not sure it's united. I don't know whether it's an empire. You could probably ask the Argentinians what they think about the Malvinas, or you could ask the Spaniards what they think about Gibraltar. The British don't certainly think of themselves as imperial anymore, so probably no.
Probably no. What if I ask a Scot or a Welshman or a...
Well, this is it, isn't it? You get this. I mean, already you've come to the crunch of the problem, which is that there are empires, or what it might be empires, are perceived very, very differently from the perspective of outside and also from the perspective of within. And secondly, that there is, as it were, a difference between what you might call a functional empire, in other words, China today as an empire, and what they call themselves, what they think of themselves. In other words, the majority Chinese don't think of themselves as an empire, though clearly your perspective might be very different if you're in Tibet or if you're in Sinkiang, or for that matter, if you do not like the prospect of Chinese rule in Taiwan.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So let's get to the crux of the linguistic issue. This is a word that is fraught with difficulties because it seems to have many meanings, that people conflate it with other things and they differentiate it from things it shouldn't be differentiated from. Is there any neutral accepted definition of an empire? I'm laughing because I wouldn't want to answer that question myself.
Well, the answer is there isn't. And there isn't, not least, if you look at that question across space and across time. So in other words, if you were looking at the present moment, I mean, it's not literally if we were just going to be talking to a Chinese person about politics. If you were actually looking in other languages at the present day, you would find words which do not necessarily have completely coterminous meanings. And so what one is pushed back with, and this is not necessarily a bad thing, because there is a difference between, on the one hand, the idea of very rigid analytical typologies, and on the other hand, the complete mess of postmodernist anything is what you think you like. They're actually, both of those are deeply flawed. The postmodernism is ridiculous because it creates the idea that you can imagine yourself as whatever you would like to be. And obviously we can see that at the moment with people imagining themselves as whatever they want to be. But you can imagine yourself as whatever you want to be. And that ignores fundamental realities. you know, you might get coal in place A, but not place B. It is colder in place A, but not in place B. Some people have more genetic characteristics that we would generally regard as male than others do, and so on and so forth. So, you know, you can have that situation of reality in which you say, no, we mustn't accept a postmodernist mess. But on the other hand, to go for rigid analytical concepts in which meanings have a unitary meaning across time and space, as if they are a mathematical notation, and as if history, therefore, is a science with a fixed notational system, is naive. It is also risks, I don't like using the term privileging, but let's just say it risks putting a priority on some interpretations rather than others. So what I've tried to do in a number of my books, I've tried to do it in when I wrote on geopolitics, I've tried to do it when I've written on maps, I've tried to do it when I've written on war, is to accept that there are workable definitions which are not accepted by all, and which indeed at any one time one knows are less than complete, and to also say that it's not terribly helpful to get stuck in definitional terms. I mean, you see it when you know it. I mean, in other words, whatever you might say, however you play with the definitions, Luxembourg is not an empire. So, you know, there are practical, and you know, I couldn't prove in definitional terms that Luxembourg isn't an empire. Maybe Luxembourgers have an ambition to be an empire, I don't know. But you and I will know, and our listeners will know, that Luxembourg isn't an empire. So I think a working assumption, assuming that the people listening, which we are, you know, that people are not stupid, they don't need a fixed definition to understand things. So on that basis, let's just talk about empires.
All right. So, and I didn't prepare you for this question, so you may not be able to answer it, but I bet you can. What is the history of the word empire?
The history of the concept empire goes right the way back. The time I would say when it most features at an early stage in contemporary understandings is very much the Greek perception of the Persians. I mean, obviously there are empires prior to that. One can think, for example, of Egyptian expansion into the Near East. I think I've already mentioned China. So the imperial reality comes there before, shall we say, we can find text, or looked at differently. Text can be seen differently. So that if you want, sorry, that's a terrible sentence, but I'm tired, jet lagged. Looked at differently, text can be understood in a variety of ways. So if you're looking at the Ramesses II and other imperial rulers and the way they are celebrated in stone and in other decorative media, and the same with the Assyrians, they are celebrating the fact that they are able to act as an imperial presence without there necessarily being a written text to say that they are. But if you're thinking about the Greeks responding to the Persians, the Greek perception of the Persians provides a lot of the background of the sort of the origins of what one might call an anti-imperial rhetoric, in the sense that here you are, you're the Greeks, you present yourself as civilized, and you present yourself as having a vast force of others who you see as barbarians of some shape or other. We're not talking about accuracy here, we're talking about perception. And you then embark on a heroic struggle, and that heroic struggle sees a number of episodes. So Marathon out of the first invasion, Thermopylae, Salamis out of the second invasion. And from that, you construct a mythos of a anti-imperial reality in which there was an empire that's outside. Of course, the hilarious thing is that Athens then subsequently, as we know, acts as an imperial power and brutalizes those within its Athenian-ruled federal system which don't do what it wants, and that in a sense, you've then got the second point, which is always true, which you referred to at the beginning, which is that empire is a matter of perceptions. And many states today, if we can bring this up to the present moment, which ground themselves on an anti-imperial historical myth. In other words, we were founded by breaking free from this evil empire, let's say the Brits or the French, or from fighting this other evil empire, let's say the Americans. And we, of course, are, you know, sort of pure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I think if you were a Yemeni suffering the arrival of Egyptian soldiers in the 1960s, or if you lived in Papua New Guinea, the western side, Irian New Guinea, and suffering from the Indonesians, or for that matter, when the Indonesians went into East Timor, you might have had a very different view of what is empire. And I think this is a very important point, but rather than it presenting due to a failure of definition, what it reflects rather is that there are always differing ways to understand a reality, and the reality, of course, is the nature of power and the threat that power poses to other interests.
Mm-hmm. Well, a friend of mine, and I'm sure this is not original to him, liked to say that an empire is what you call a competitor state that has just defeated you.
Well, I mean, I think certainly what that captures is a modern perception, but a perception that certainly you could also see back through time. It has a long historical genesis. Now, today, the idea of being an empire is bitterly unpopular, so nobody wants to call themselves an empire, and therefore you immediately present imperialism as something that the other does. Going back in time, it wasn't quite the same, because not everybody was unhappy about being seen as an empire. But nevertheless, you would pose the values of a hostile imperialism on those who are your opponents. And you would apply that with a very vigorous brush in order to present them as an existential challenge to yourself. One last point before we move on. In looking at the origins of empire, we tend to do this in obviously a secularist fashion, which reflects, you know, our modern perceptions. But it's worth bearing in mind that empire, for many people, clearly carried with it a sense of providential destiny. Of course, that lasted definitely into the early 20th century. But if you go back in time, that providential destiny in part was related to the idea that the emperor figure was a semi-god, as it were, or indeed a god, or could carry out on behalf of the people sacral type of rites. So there is this notion of imperialism in which the ruler is a deistic or semi-deistic or priestly figure. And you can see that in China, you can see that in Egypt, you can see that, for example, in Mesoamerica, what we might call Mexico, with the Aztecs in the 15th century. And that notion of rulership is important, and it gives you a much deeper sense of rival empires, because these are rival, if you want to use the term religion as magic, in the sense that the ruler is applying magic or is able to sort of focus the potency of their links to the deities, you know, things like ancient Rome, then I think that's very, very important to the tradition of empire. And I think we can sharpen that up in the case of, I mean, obviously it's true of the Chinese trajectory, but we can sharpen that up in the case of a number of empires. And if you're thinking of the Ottoman Empire, for example, the degree to which the Ottoman Sultan was a caliph, the degree to which the Ottoman Sultan was the guardian of the holy places in Medina and Mecca gives them a particular role. Now, it doesn't mean that people don't rebel. It doesn't mean that many sultans weren't murdered. But it certainly means that you cannot present Ottoman imperialism simply as if it was taking part in some optimal form of political organization, which is the way a lot of people discuss things. Or, of course, if you're looking at the West's tradition, one of the significant aspects of the West's tradition is that, of course, it is under Imperial Rome that Christianity becomes the established religion in Europe. It's under Imperial Spain and Portugal that it becomes the established religion and what becomes Latin America. And therefore, there is a particular degree of authority that goes with the imperial legacy, particularly in Europe, the legacy of going back to Rome. And you can see that with the way in which Charlemagne in 800, you know, the leading, if you wish to use the term barbarian, you know, I'm putting it in inverted commas, but if you, the leading barbarian ruler, the, you know, of what had been the Western Roman Empire, the way he goes to Rome, the way he gets himself crowned as emperor, the way he recharges in the West in a parallel way to Byzantium in the Eastern Roman Empire. He recharges the imperial legacy because he sees that legacy as significant. And the gap today is that in many countries there are obviously functioning empires. You know, modern India is a functioning empire. You've only got to ask some Kashmiri who's having the, you know, the guts kicked out of him by some Indian policeman. You know, modern India is a functioning empire, but the they are not looking back to the tradition of Mughal India or the traditions of pre-Mughal empires, let alone to the evil Brits.
Yes, I think what you say is absolutely true in the Russian case, which I know best because when the Russian state formed, it was actually the Muscovite state at the time in the 16th century, really. They went far back and invented what was essentially a genealogy that connected them to Roman emperors. I mean, the word Tsar is a derivation of Caesar, and they thought of themselves as a bearer of this imperial legacy that went back.
But they were the third Rome. Were they
yes,
the third
well,
Rome?
Yeah, that's I can say a lot about that. I wrote a lot about
yeah,
that.
And but, no, it's, but it's you can. Yeah. But on top of that, let's also point out that they weren't the only people in the Byzantine world that did that. The Bulgars
did exactly the
same thing in the 11th yeah. century. And you could argue, if you really wanted to be interesting as well, you could argue that there are extents to which the Ottomans draw on elements of the Byzantine tradition. And there is the argument, I personally think it's a bit forced, but nevertheless, there is the argument that the competition in the early 16th century between Suleiman the Magnificent and the Emperor Charles V, Habsburg Empire, is in both cases looking back deliberately and explicitly to Roman elements and competing for the legacy of the Roman Empire. I think there's much else, in fact. But nevertheless, in iconographical terms, that is certainly there. And there is also this deep nature of societies that are reverential of the past and referential to the past. And what is interesting at the present day, if you're in, let us say, the West, but not just the West, you could see the same thing in other non-Western societies, not all of them, is that this willingness to refer to the past in a positive way, in other words, to see positive structures, positive practices, positive identities in the past, is less pronounced and sometimes is directly controverted, of course. And therefore, we don't really find it so easy to appreciate the way that in the past, people who, for example, might be supporting change, let's say Protestants in the 16th century with the Reformation, the way they often presented that is to go back to what they saw as the primitive virtue of the early church against the accretions of, as they saw it, the papacy, rather than to say, right, chaps, we're starting anew, because the notion of starting anew, of seeking a mandate in some way, whether democratic or other, from wherever you are at the moment, is in practical terms quite a modernistic one.
Yes, I think that's right. I want to stick with the medieval and early modern moment for a second, because one of the things I know from studying the Russian Empire is that from the perspective of the Russians, and I mean the elites here who were building it, it was a very good thing. And they had lots of reasons to say that people should want to be under Russian rule. And I think one of the things they said is that they would bring to them not only Orthodox Christianity, which they obviously had a vested, indeed spiritual interest in, but also they would pacify very large areas that were often at war. And they claimed to act as, and I think they did, act as a kind of policeman from afar. And this can be a very good thing for people, they argued.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that the notion that empire is inherently a bad thing because it represents the suppression of, a kind of Saxon myth of free peoples congregating together in primeval forests, being pure and having nice thoughts. And then you get these evil barbarian empires bringing in sort of cruel things like sort of the perils of civilization or eating meat or some such thing you don't like. I think that is really a sort of fantasy, this sort of and in practical terms, firstly, the choice between empire, the choice if you were not if you're looking at empire, is either often between different empires or between empire and a form of chaos. And that form of chaos was often that of tribal chiefs fighting each other. It was often that, and I mean, indeed, it's worth bearing in mind if you're looking at Greece, since Greece tended to be the first of the great narrators of an anti-imperial ideology. It's worth bearing in mind that Philip of Macedon, who obviously conquers Greece and who is denounced by Demosthenes, those Demosthenes texts are important. I mean, the Greeks have been kicking the hell out of each other before Philip of Macedon turns up. And just as, for that matter, something that people found it quite convenient to forget about, when the Persians turned out, the Greeks were already antagonistic to each other, and indeed on the basis of that, some, as in Thessaly, for example, or Boetica, cooperated with the Persians, whereas others opposed them. So, I would agree with you. Empire was often a form of keeping the peace, and not that that was necessarily the intention, but it was often the consequence. And ironically, if you wish to use, and I'm not necessarily saying that I endorse this view, but if you want to think about the modern notion which gathered traction in the 1990s with people like Tony Blair of liberal interventionism as, sort of, as it were, supporting some sort of set of norms against whatever you didn't like, and let's be clear about this, what they didn't like was in many senses not very attractive, but nevertheless, there was a quasi-imperial character to it, whether or not it was dressed up as imperialism or not. And that then takes you to the next stage. If you are being policed by some United Nations army or some force from NATO or some force from the EU or at the behest of those organizations, or indeed of, there's an African equivalent and so on. It's not just the organizations we're talking about. If that is the case, you may feel you are in receipt of a form of pressure that is akin to that of being subject to an empire. Now, the fact that it might not call itself an empire doesn't mean you don't necessarily understand it in that light.
Mm-hmm. I think the starting point of all, maybe it's not the starting point because historians don't like starting points, but perhaps the starting point of all modern criticism of empires is, in fact, some form of nationalism that kind of crystallizes, I guess, in Wilsonian principles that again goes back to this kind of myth of free peoples gathering together in a kind of Rousseauian way and, I don't know, circling around the fire and deciding their fate because they all speak the same language and worship the same God, supposedly. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of that particular criticism?
Oh, yes. Well, that idea goes right the way back. So if you go back to antiquity, you could see, for example, and let's just stick to the, I mean, I could talk about the Chinese legacy, but let's just stick with the European one because I think listeners would be most familiar with that. If you're looking at the European one, so you see Tacitus's description of the Caledonians in his Agricola, or Josephus's description of the Jews, are both of them presenting peoples in that light fighting against Rome, the Caledonians eventually successfully, which is why Gibbon gets interested in them, the Jews eventually unsuccessfully, which ironically is why Jewish ideas, not notably in the shape of Christianity, are able to spread much more widely than Caledonian ideas. Not that I'm saying that the Caledonians necessarily had comparable ideas, but you get the point, the ironies of history. And then if you look at the medieval period, I mean, there are earlier and other examples, but if I could give you a few, the idea, the mythos that developed among the Swiss fighting the Habsburgs, or the Scots fighting the English, or the Flemings fighting the French, all of those play a role. I mean, obviously, you'll be familiar also with the way in which the Russians tap into an idea about themselves being against expansion by the Teutonic Knights and by the Swedes. So all of those ideas are there in present during what we call the medieval age, if not earlier. And you use the term nationalism, and maybe at one stage we ought to have a podcast on nationalism, because what's interesting about this is so often historians, many of whom I'm afraid to say, I mean, I'm sure they're individually nice people and might be kind to their dogs, but many of whom I'm afraid to say tend to focus on what they work on as the key element. Most historians of nationalism work on the last 200 years, so what a surprise. They say you get true nationalism in the last 200 or 250 years, and that prior to that you didn't get true nationalism. You got something that might be called proto-nationalism, but it wasn't true nationalism. I think that's ridiculous. I think that's absolutely absurd as a distinction. And much that we would associate with a sort of anti-imperial nationalism is present in the medieval period, and really is push-started in Europe even further in the 16th century. So if you're thinking about Luther, you're thinking about works like Ulrich von Hutten's Arminius, looking back, of course, to ancient German opposition to the Romans. If you're thinking about German literature condemning both the Emperor Charles V and the papacy, you have got what they would call a Caesaropapalism. You have got nationalism there. If you're looking at the English counterpart, the idea of a national English church, which is opposed to the authority and power of the Habsburgs and the papacy, this is nationalism full kilt. And so you've got nationalism there, and a lot of that is presented in an anti-imperial guise or form, and is believed in that line. But as you yourself have said, I mean, if you look at England in the 16th century, if you were Irish, you might not have seen the English as these benign anti-imperial people. And indeed, famously, in the Act in Restraint of Appeals, in other words, saying that nothing should go as an appeal to Rome, and that national courts were sovereign. Thomas Cromwell drafting Henry VIII's legislation has England declared an empire in itself. So the very idea of expressing nationalism is to present yourself as an empire. Now, what you're seeing yourself as a meritorious empire, and indeed the English stroke later British had a long tradition of seeing themselves as a meritorious empire and not being at all upset about the idea that people would call them an empire. They were quite happy to use that term. Yeah, now, go on.
I was going to say, I certainly take the point that many historians make that modern nationalism as a political force, which evolved, I suspect, in the 18th or 19th century, at least in Europe, it can be said, you can trace it pretty well. But I often wonder if many of these historians have ever read the Old Testament, because it certainly looks like in the Old Testament that that's a kind of nationalism itself. The Hebrews, the Jews, they were thinking of themselves as a people who were suffering under other people.
You're right.
That's the theme of the book.
You're right. And actually a key characteristic of identity in the ancient worlds, and I say worlds because there were many around the world, our globe, is the linkage of sacral authority and a distinctive religious identity to your sense of destiny and to your sense of opposition to other peoples. Now, there are some religions that survive in that fashion today, and which are primarily, you could argue, ethnic religions. And I don't mean that by that to be pejorative or to be praiseworthy. So you can think of Judaism, you can think of the Sikhs, you can think of Shinto in Japan, and those are not by any means unique. But most modern religions claim to be sort of comprehensive, open to everybody, etc., etc., etc. That is not actually the way religion generally was as a force and an element in the ancient world, and in particular as a political force. And so therefore, we looped back to Rome. I mean, it is no accident that the Romans had initially before Christianity. So they had many centuries of a pantheon of their own gods. When they conquered somewhere else, they would, because they were polytheistic, they would often, if the people were willing, integrate their gods into the Roman pantheon. But of course, with the Roman gods being the chief gods, I mean, that was the, after all, the key empire that counts is the empire in heaven, as it were, not the things down on earth. And so the idea was very much of religion as a form of power and identity. And obviously, that makes them very hostile to those religions, of which the Druids are a good example in England, and eventually, not all Jews, but eventually the Jews are, which are religions that sort of are apt to reject this idea of a polytheistic system.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of a great irony in the case of Christianity, which is about as ecumenical as you can get, because pretty much anybody can become a Christian by accepting Jesus as your Lord and Savior, as I'm from the Midwest, and I've seen this many times, is that in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, essentially the forces of nationalism as a kind of political tool were so powerful that all the Christian churches were essentially nationalized. They became national entities, and the Russian case is very clear here. There is a Russian Orthodox Church.
Yes, and I mean, you could say that much of the political tension, I mean, I would actually sort of take it much earlier than that, much of the political tension and narrative in the West, I mean, you know, Byzantium is a good example of that, and if you look west of Byzantium, much of the political tension is to do with rivalries between emperors and popes, with emperors, of course, if they're not happy with the pope setting up their own, what was called an anti-pope, and popes trying to overthrow emperors they didn't like. Now, in that period, there was also, at the same time as there was this greater struggle between within Western Christendom, there was also an extent to which in individual polities or countries, let's say what you want, however you want to call them, territories might be better, the practicality was actually, despite the universal church, which is how the Catholic Church presented itself, papacy presented itself, there was a great extent to which, you know, let's say Peter Linehan's book on Castile in the 13th century, I mean, is a book in which essentially the rulers of Castile and the local clergy, yes, they get their instructions from Innocent III, and most of them, they treat them as if, you know, it's things that we can ignore. Nor that. And so I think one has to be pragmatic here. The nature of what in the 16th century was often enacted within the Catholic Church as concordats, which were deals between monarchs or territories and the papacy, in which essentially the papacy accepted that they were going to appoint as bishops or archbishops people who were subjects of that ruler, so which was a form of nationalization, if you want to use that more modern term. In reality, that was actually often the case earlier on. And that, of course, helps to also, if you want to then take the dynamo further, that helps to give you another strand of what you might call this struggle of nationalism, if you wish to use that term, that the international perspective was often set by international preaching orders or friar orders, so the Franciscans, the Dominicans, later, of course, in the 16th century, the Jesuits. And of course, the states, as it were, act against these. And one of the great actions of nationalism, if you wish to use that term, I think there are other terms we could use, is the way in which the Society of Jesus, the Jesuit order, is suppressed in the second half of the 18th century, precisely because rulers like the rulers of Portugal and Naples and of France do not want to have an international order which doesn't obey their instructions, and they're able to draw on a powerful amount of sentiment to that end from within their own countries, including from within the church.
Well, I should say this is still going on all over the world. I mean, if you look at, in the case of Russia, there are lots of what we would call just Christian sects. I mean, from the American perspective, sects, that's just what we do. You know, like, you couldn't count the number of kinds of Protestantism that we have. But from the Russian perspective, you know, having even like Latter-day Saints or Seventh-day Adventists or something such as this in their midst is not it's not a simple thing for them.
Yes, no, I agree with you. But the point we're drawing round, and this is, I think, I hope that the listeners will pick up, is that nationalism, although often seen as an aspect of modernism, modernization, and the modern world, has a much longer history, part of that history being anti-imperial, if you wish to use that term. And as a cognate of that, imperialism, which is a term which, or empire, if you like, which is a term which is often historicized and treated as pre-modern in some respects, actually can also be applied in the modern age. That, so what we're trying to do is to take apart the standard chronological assumptions that underlay a lot of the historical analysis.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, because a kind of nationalism can be a kind of imperialism. In the example that comes to mind is what I might call, I'm just inventing this on the fly, but a kind of, it's almost messianic nationalism. And that you see this with especially Americans and Wilson. I don't know if American is a nation or an empire. I don't know what it is, but this idea that somehow it's fit and proper and only right, and all right thinking people believe that, well, something like self-determination, that every linguistic group or every group that identifies itself as an X ought to have its own nation. And this is not questioned anymore. This is just a fact of the world. Like, this is the way things have to be.
Yes. I mean, obviously, it's an absurdity in a number of respects. I mean, leave aside, you can end up giving sovereign power to sort of three people, as it were. But, you know, the absurdity is it ignores the extent to which you do not have the organization of the world in this neat, homogenous sections. It leads to the trashing of minority groups. So it's no accident that if you were a Copt, you were better off under the British Empire than under independent Egypt. If you were a Jew, you were better, or an Armenian, you were better off under the British or French empires than you were under successor states, national successor states, so-called. So first of all, there's that element. Second of all, there is the element of mixture. I mean, as I said, you do not get these straight lines separating widely different ethnicities. And indeed, the notion of national self-determination has launched, or the idea of it has launched many, many, many wars. And the idea that it is in some way morally better to be slaughtered as a result of one of those wars than to be slaughtered as a result of a so-called imperialist war, I think is a very questionable idea. And it's part and parcel of the thing. I mean, I don't know if you know this, one of my books was trashed in The Guardian this year, which is fair enough. It's quite amusing to have criticism. But essentially, the author got very upset because I'd tried to explain. I hadn't tried to justify, I'd just tried to explain British policy at the time of Amritsar in 1919. And one of the things I'd done, which he really took against, was, you know, I'd put it in the context of the use of violence by the post-independence Indian state, indeed including in Amritsar in 1984, but also, you know, massacres of Sikhs in other places. And, you know, what was very clear from the response, and, you know, from the Twitter feed in Britain that followed this, was that in some way it was acceptable for these people, thought it was acceptable for the Indians to brutalize people today because India is a independent state, whereas for the British to kill far more people in what I happen to think was a terrible and awful episode. I'm not in any way extenuating it. I'm just simply saying one does also need to contextualize it, was somehow morally worse. And I just find this absolutely bizarre. And we get the same thing with slavery. I mean, slavery in the 18th century was clearly horrible. I mean, but, you know, people today seem happier to, you know, go and chant about slavery in the 18th century than they are to deal with the fact that, you know, the inhabitants of North Korea today are slaves. they ask, and that state slavery exists, and people don't seem to care about. Or if you want to have personal slavery, there is personal slavery in places like Pakistan, Mauritania, and people who are quite happy to, you know, get really worked up about the past, and we're talking about a long way, a long past, seem to be curiously oblivious of the present. And, you know, you're talking about empire. I mean, here again, something which we discussed, which is this question of whether the United States is an empire. Well, let's just take for a second the question of that. This is often discussed not in a functional fashion, but it's discussed as part of a narrative in which people are hostile to the United States. And the term imperialism provides for many of them not a convenient and perceptive and cool-headed analytical term, but rather part of a rhetoric of anger. Well, you know, there are actions that the United States does that, you know, one could well think about. But it is ironic, is it not, that much of the anger directed against the United States is not shared by anger directed against other states, which are without a doubt authoritarian, if not in some cases tyrannical, which are dictatorial, and which are apt to brutalize their neighbors. And, you know, it's Russian troops in Crimea. It's not American troops in Crimea. And you know, it's the Chinese putting people in large-scale prison camps. If you wish to use the term concentration camps to be emotive, you can. Let's just say prison camps, which I think more accurate. Large-scale prison camps in Xinjiang is in somehow regarded as less important than the Americans putting terrorists and as much smaller number of them in Guantanamo Bay. So I think there is a profound sense here of a lack of perspective in much of the discussion of what is purported to be American imperialism.
Before we embark on a discussion of American imperialism, I want to go back to one thing that we talked about a little bit, and that is there's a certain irony among, I guess I would call them nation states or states that think of themselves as nation states, that is that they are often empires themselves. And I know this only because I studied early modern history quite a bit. And many of the people who were unified in Germany or unified in France or unified in Russia, and we think of as Russians, ask the Ukrainians, they do not think of themselves as French or German or Russian. They think of themselves in a different way, but you never really hear about this. And it usually falls into the category, if it's criticized at all, as oppression of national minorities. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. And I mean, I can give you other examples. I mean, Neapolitans or Sicilians for a long time regarded themselves as being ruled by Piedmontese imperialism rather than being Italians. And indeed, that affected all sorts of things like the attitude to law and order, the attitude to conscription. So I would agree with you entirely that what we think of as nation states are often states that have arisen from conflict in which a large amount of fighting was done against those who would now be regarded as compatriots. And what that underlines is the extent to which the analytical groups in geographical terms that we employ are very, very suspect. Now, you could take that a stage further and say the degree to which ethnicities could be understood in the same term, that ethnicities are not necessarily in some, you know, whatever you mean by, foundational or fashion that have gone on through history in a seamless way. By their nature, many of them have a rather mixed DNA and a capacity to integrate different groups. So I would agree with you absolutely. You can see the same thing in Spanish history. And indeed, it's ironic, of course, at the present moment that in Catalonia, there is a sort of independence movement, separatist movement, which the Castilians are violently opposed to. But, you know, in their own time, Castile managed to conquer, for example, Andalusia, managed to conquer Granada. You could argue if you wanted to, I mean, I'm not sure how helpful this argument is, that Castile is a conglomerate in which you've got ethnicities that go back to pre-Roman, Roman period, Celtic, barbarian groups, including the Suevi as well as the Visigoths, etc., etc. Then a large dollop of Berber and a small dollop of Arab as well. So the idea that there hasn't been a plasticity in the Iberian Peninsula, that you know for some reason it's okay for Portugal to be independent, although a lot of Castilians in the past haven't wanted it to be, but Catalonia being independent is outrageous. I think that's ridiculous. And I have to say, there are loads and loads and loads and loads of problems with British history and with Britain at the present day. But I did think that one of the more impressive features of the very unimpressive recent years was that when the Scottish independence referendum was held in 2014, although there was a certain amount of intimidation of voters who didn't want to become independent, you know, they had stones thrown through their windows and that sort of thing by nationalist bullies, it wasn't at the same sort of level that you would get in most countries, and that the British government at that time had made it clear that if the majority of Scots wanted to go, they would be happy for them to do so. Well, they would be prepared for them to do so. Happy is the wrong word. Actually, the thing is, and here I will tell a bad joke and everybody can shout at me, the joke that was going around my bit of England at the time was that, of course, that the big mistake with the Scottish referendum was that they didn't offer the English the vote for Scotland's independence, because the English would have voted for Scotland to go. But we'll leave that to one side.
Well, it's kind of funny you mentioned that, because many of my Russian friends will say something similar about the dissolution of the Soviet Union. It was really the Russians that wanted out.
Yes. Well, actually, I mean, in many senses, that was literally true. Of course, Yeltsin, in effect, was the figure. Yeltsin, just to remind everybody, was the person in charge of the government of Russia of that period, the Russian Federation, as opposed to the Soviet Union. Yeltsin, of course, was the instrumental figure at breaking up the Soviet Union. So in some respects, yes, there was an element of Russian nationalism there. Although, of course, what it did do was leave about 25 million Russians ethnic Russians, whatever term you wish to use, as subjects of the new other republics.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And if you ask people in Eastern Ukraine what they are, they're always very confused because they don't really know. I mean, they're Russian-speaking people, and often they're Orthodox, and they think of themselves as members of this thing that doesn't exist anymore, the Soviet Union, and then before that, the Russian Empire. But on the other hand, they are Ukrainian citizens. And then there are these Russian troops. And so it's very confusing for those people, I think.
Well, yes, yeah. And I'll take that a stage further, because you see the same thing in Britain. I mean, it's very, very interesting. I wrote a book, there's no reason for you to know this, about English nationalism, I wrote this in the shadow of the Scottish referendum, to try and ask the question, well, what would England look like in an English sense of identity, in an English sense of history, without Scotland, and one assumes without Northern Ireland as well? And what's interesting is the self-identification in Britain, of immigrant groups in particular. Many of them will say themselves something like, I am Pakistani and British. And what's interesting is that not so many of them would say, I'm Pakistani in English. And that's interesting. And I don't know whether it's because it's an echo of the British Empire. I don't know it's whether that Britain has for them a more positive image than England. I simply don't know. But your point about identities and how people have to confront identities is one that's very much been part of 20th century history. I mean, if you remember the beginning of the Wasteland, near the beginning of the Wasteland, and there's that cafe scene in Munich in which the woman is telling you in German that she is really Echt Deutsch, you know, she's really German, but in practical terms, you know, she's come from the Eastern Baltic, and she is struggling, as many emigres did, to try and establish what her identity is in a period made complex by nation states. So looping back to Woodrow Wilson, what Woodrow Wilson did, I mean, it wasn't his intention. I mean, he was a very stupid man, exactly what you'd expect of an academic president at Princeton. What he did was create a situation in which large numbers of people were like that. They were uncertain of their identity, they were unwelcome in these new states, and they were refugees where they went to who were unwelcome there as well. So I think I have to tell you that anti-imperial national self-determination has been, in my view, not a helpful phenomenon. There are examples where it was probably, if one, and I think moral concepts are okay in history. I don't agree with people that think they should be, play no role. I think it was a good thing, obviously, that the Soviet Union succumbed, and it's a very good, and nobody who visits places, as I've done, like, you know, many of the former republics, cannot but be happy that they are no longer ruled from Moscow. But on the other hand, one has to be aware that in many places, most obviously between Armenia and Azerbaijan, they led to conflict in which large numbers of people were cruelly killed. They also led in some places to corrupt kleptocracies, most obviously in former Soviet Central Asia. So, you know, you are then moving to the situation that you shouldn't assume an empire is necessarily worse, however unattractive that empire might be.
Yeah, or even a cobbled together nation state or nation state with a kind of titular nationality. I'm thinking of Yugoslavia, for example. If you talk to people who lived in the former Yugoslavia, there's, and I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but
oh, get into trouble. I mean, you can't. Can I just say, as an academic, you're a former college professor, and you know as well as I do that the modern idea that you shouldn't say anything that upsets people is exactly the reverse of what really is the purpose of education, which is to get people to think. And the easiest way to get them to think is to confront them with ideas that they don't want to have or that they find unwelcome. If somebody comes away from one of my lectures saying, I know why he is wrong and I've thought out three reasons why he is wrong, the lecture has worked because I have provoked them. No, because I've provoked them to think. The trouble is these days, most students do that, and I have good relations with former students and good relations with current students, but I'm afraid to say this kind of ludicrous idea which you get that you mustn't say anything unwelcome means A, that you can't teach large areas, and B, that anybody who is disaffected can cause trouble, and that, you know, management's, you know, of universities are only too ready to, you know, to respond by telling off the academic. So no, one should say things. One should be a free-thinking individual. If we cannot think freely as a species, we are not going to do very well.
Well, let me put the observation in as diplomatic way as I can, and that is that many people I know or have had contact with who lived in the former territory of Yugoslavia have great nostalgia for Yugoslavia. And I don't think the dissolution of Yugoslavia in a kind of moral sense went very well.
Oh, I agree with you entirely. I agree with you absolutely. And indeed, what that showed was, I mean, you created nation states. The Slovene nation state worked quite well for a number of historical reasons. The creation of the Croat and Serb nation states did not go well because of the distribution of people, because of the cruelty of the regimes established in both places, because of the nature of the warfare they practiced, and because people weren't conveniently located. So you get a corollary. It is not an accident. A corollary of national self-determination is ethnic cleansing, so-called, which means vicious brutality. Let's be clear about it. And that, you know, it's not an add-on because of some failure. And one of the things that is worth bearing in mind is that this kind of people seem to accept in some way, as I said earlier, a greater degree of violence from nation states than they accept from imperial powers. I mean, you know, anybody murdered, anybody brutalized is a crime. So, you know, 20 million people being brutalized is 20 million crimes. It is not actually a completely different nature that there is crime as opposed to no crime. But people need to have some sort of sense of grip here. It is much worse to kill or brutalize millions than it is to kill or brutalize small numbers. And on the whole, on the whole, the states that sought to create ethnically homogenous units were pretty vicious and pretty nasty. And ironically, they acted in a way to parallel the most vicious of all of the I suppose it shares it with the Soviet Union and Communist China, but let's just say the most vicious of the states securely in the Western tradition, which is Nazi Germany, in that Nazi Germany's ambition in this respect was to create a state that was Judenfrei, no Jews. That was a form of ethnic cleansing of the most brutal and vicious fashion, but in a way it corresponded with a kind of nation-state imperialism, because the idea was you didn't want this other ethnicity, which had, as you know, we know all about the weird views of people like Himmler and Hitler, which had an alternative magic that they were really thought of as highly sinister, as well as seeing Judaism as correspondingly and at the same time both left wing and right wing.
Mm-hmm. I know that our time is coming to a close.
But we must do another one soon.
Yeah, we should. But I want to ask you about this term that you've used a couple of times, and that is a functional empire. What is a functional empire, and what are examples of them today?
Well, a functional empire is, first of all, a place that doesn't call itself an empire and may, in fact, not have what we understand as an imperial ideology, but is an empire depending upon whatever is your definition of an empire, because it functions like that. So there has been discussion, you will know, as to whether the United States is an empire. You will know that. There has been discussion even recently as to whether the European Union is an empire. You will know that. No. I mean, I happen to think it isn't an empire, but, you know, I'm just talking about. So these are terms in which, depending upon your definition, you can end up with an argument that these are an empire. I would argue that much more clearly modern India is an empire. I would argue much more clearly that modern China and modern Indonesia are all functional empires. So I think, you know, they don't have an imperial ideology, although the BJP seems to be pushing India in that direction of sort of a sectarian Hindu ideology of that type. But essentially, they don't have an imperial ideology, but functionally, they have many of the characteristics of imperial powers.
Yeah, I think the case of India is very interesting, and I don't know a lot about it, but I know that from my Indian friends that they're always Indian and something else, because there are so many different kinds of Indians.
Well, I mean, the sort of thing is, I mean, imperial characteristics, for example, a determination to dominate the borderlands and to push others back. So the great game with China in the Himalayas, the Indian determination to try and dominate Nepal, the attempt to dominate the Northeast, the conflict against people in places like Nagaland, the anti-Islamic ideology and practice in Kashmir, the habit of interfering in weaker neighbors, whether it's Sri Lanka or the Maldives. You know, there is a lot there that you could say is that of a classic imperial power. And of course, the irony there is that it's in an imperial race with another imperial power, which is China. And as China expands its power into near India, into places like Myanmar, which we used to call Burma, or to Sri Lanka, which we used to call Ceylon, or, you know, establishing its base at Gwalior on the coast of Baluchistan in Pakistan. So the Indians in turn trying to build up their navy, and as if we're in an Anglo-German naval race at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think that these you could call functionally empires. You know, the fact that I think the confusion for modern people is most people today think an empire is something ruled by an emperor, Napoleon, or the Empire of Brazil, or the attempt in the 1860s to create an empire in Mexico, or the empire in China, which lasted until the 1910s. But an empire is not necessarily something that is under an emperor. That is the key point. And you go all the way back. There was the Republican Rome was an empire by, 40 BC. The fact that it didn't have an emperor yet didn't mean it wasn't an empire. And so therefore, people have to get their head round the idea that you might have an ideology that is democratic, like modern India, or an ideology which claims to be a sort of popular, sort of leading edge for the people, as with modern China. But these can still be imperial, even if President Xi doesn't, or Mr. Modi, don't call themselves emperors.
I know that you have a hard stop. So let me say that we've been talking with Jeremy Black, the wonderful Jeremy Black, who does indeed know everything. And this has been a fascinating conversation. And I want to do it again. In fact, I want to agree on our next discussion. Can it be nationalism? Because I think you probably...
I would be delighted.
That would be good. So the people that listen to the New Books Network and listen to all these interviews, you can look forward to a discussion by me, the ignorant, with Jeremy, who knows everything.
Don't be silly, Marshall. That's a ridiculous thing. And it is embarrassing. Can I just say, no. The more that you work at a subject, the more you know that you do not know. What you to do is to advance and offer concepts and methods that others will apply or at least disagree with. And history is not a question of knowing a lot of facts. What history is about is it's a habit of humane, skeptical, not cynical, but humane, skeptical thought. And my key view on history, and I suppose this is as an ideological position, but we ought to be wary of ideologies, whether they are the formal ideologies of things like communism or socialism or fascism, or whether they are the implicit ideologies of forms of particular types of historical method. Prescriptive historical method. Now, I'm delighted to have been talking to you. I've been speaking from Shreveport, my first visit here, and let me tell you, I've never been to Shreveport before. It is actually very pleasant indeed, and I would recommend others coming here.
Well, that's terrific. I recommend people go to Shreveport too. So our next discussion is going to be on nationalism, and Jeremy, let me say goodbye to you. Thank you for being on the show. All right. And let me say to everyone listening to this that this is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. We've been talking with Jeremy Black, and we will pick up the discussion next time. Thanks very much for listening.